Hello.
And welcome to episode 19 of Season to Taste, the Doctor Who podcast in which we watch one story from each active year of Doctor Who. There are 35 of those, and we have watched 18 stories, the 18th of which was The Ambassadors
of Death.
Wow. So, Matthew, what did you think of Doctor Who and the Quatermass experiment?
Well, it was utterly bizarre. I kind of really like it, but I like it because it's really strange rather than it's actually any good.
I think it is any good, but it's odd. I think we may have mentioned in the last podcast, it gets overlooked because of where it is. It's sandwiched between the Silurians and Inferno, two rather more remarkable seven-part stories in that season.
You could have spun a whole series out of the Silurians waking up and, you know, what the implications are, and you could have spun a whole series, as they did with Sliders, out of jumping between parallel universes or predestination or whatever.
You say that, but I do kind of think that The Ambassadors of Death feels like a 60s spy series. It feels quite different from the rest of Doctor Who, and that's what we were saying when it, almost as soon as it started, one of the nice things about it is different.
Yeah.
And actually, Doctor Who's quite entertaining when it's trying different things.
Yeah.
And it is kind of going for a political thriller. Yeah. There's machinations in government.
Yeah.
There's a lot of running around chasing people with guns. And it does feel like a kind of 60s action series.
I agree, and I think...
Unfortunately, it's the 70s now.
Well, it was probably made in 1969. I think most of season 7 was made
absolutely.
In 69.
Because one of the interesting things about it is it's all about probes going to Mars, and it would have been made
around the time of the moon landings. Yeah. So I think you're right. I think in the first episode, when they are getting all the maps of different places up on the screen, and Liz is speaking French to someone on the phone, and they have all the stock footage from Australia and lots of different countries, they are obviously going for that kind of global feel. And I think the location stuff is really quite astonishingly good. Obviously, they spent a lot of money on it with helicopters and full-size props of the recovery module and all of the kind of action by Havoc extras. But it's also really well directed and very pacey when it's on film.
It is. I noticed there's lots of really nice shots on film, reflections in things.
Yeah.
You know, shooting from the front of cars as they're going along.
Yeah.
When they're in that kind of factory location, that seems also to be the location for the Inferno.
Yeah.
And even when, you know, it's just people running around, it's shot in a really exciting way.
Yeah, well, Liz running over that really narrow weir, and you're thinking, Caroline, John, what were you thinking when you were pregnant and all the rest of it? But, you know, even that's really pacey and it looks really, really good. And then there's those beautiful shots, which Michael Ferguson kind of, I think, repeats from The Seeds of Death, where the Ice Warriors kind of walk towards the camera, backlit by the sun. He repeats that with the alien ambassadors. But there's just something, I think it's such a memorable image that I think it's consciously drawn on for The Impossible Astronaut, you know, decades later. Just this image of this space-suited figure reaching out towards you with the sun behind him.
There is also another reason for that, which is that when you've got a character in a spacesuit, you're trying to hide their face.
Yeah.
And by lighting them from behind, you can kind of create a silhouette and avoid showing any details. But yes, I get you entirely. It also reminded me a bit of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre and those kind of way that light is used in this kind of 70s horror way.
I think you're right there.
I wonder whether one of the reasons why there's so much, that it seems to have quite a big budget, is that there's only four stories and in this season, and by having 3 7-part stories, you really stretch your budget for sets because you're using them much more across the stories, and that then frees up the money to have more, you know, helicopters flying around them.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, I think they'd got into the habit in the previous couple of years of making much longer stories to try and save on the budget, and investing the money in, you know, one or two really impressive sets. So we recently had a quick look at the Ice Warriors DVD, and that's a story that's very much focused around one big impressive set. It lasts for 6 episodes, and, you know, they've spent the rest of the money on some monster costumes and some impressive filming over at Ealing for the glacier. So they kind of took the season 5-6 approach, I think, into season 7 in the colour.
And that meant they had enough money to pay for Tartellian's beard.
Yeah, but not a consistent accent.
Mostly consistent. There was one moment where he was on location where he did sound slightly different, and you wondered whether that was shot a month before and he kind of hadn't decided on...
I wanted him to, when Liz ran up to his car, I wanted him to say to her, "You stupid woman!"
On another production side, the music is quite unusual. There's a lot of very jolly, jaunty music. It works, but it's very different from...
There's a kind of weird jazz theme at one point when, I think, is it the Brigadier's car going into the kind of big tunnel into the space centre? Kind of a really weird, jaunty jazz number.
It does feel different from the story. It's not your traditional Dudley Simpson fare, although later on in the story, there's a bit more kind of standard noises. Yeah.
But no, I think on the production side, I think there's lots of things to really enjoy about the direction, about the sound. I think even when the Doctor goes up and sees the interior of the alien spacecraft, there's a real attempt to make it feel very alien. It's not just stepping out onto a set with some tinsel dangling forlornly off the ceiling. I mean, it's obviously CSO, but they've gone for this weird organic kind of artery. Tunnel. And then when you get glimpses of the aliens, you only ever see them very briefly. Because, let's face it, it's a story about human paranoia. It's a really interesting David Whittaker idea that actually the biggest enemy on Earth isn't alien invaders, it's not people from another country or foreigners or whatever. It's actually, you know, people with very small-minded, conservative attitudes. Those are the real enemy that the Doctor should be fighting. But I think the aliens, for all that, aren't just made to look like people with maybe, you know, green skin. They have these horrible, warty, lumpy, misshapen faces. They need radiation to live. Their spaceship's really odd and strange inside, and I think that kind of helps to sell the otherness of them. And I think that's quite important then, because clearly that encounter with that otherness has broken General Carrington's mind when he originally encountered them on Mars, and I think they needed to be that strange and that alien for that to be really convincing.
And I like that they maintain that by having them within the suits. The fact that you can't see what they are keeps them at a distance and keeps them slightly ethereal. On the subject of General Carrington, I do kind of find it a bit disappointing that when it gets to the end of the story, you're basically going, so all of this is happening because General Carrington's just a bit nuts.
I thought that was one of the most brilliant things about the story. You've just had 3 years where Doctor Who's been a little bit, if it's alien, it's evil. Patrick Troughton's Doctor famously fought the monsters all the time, and anything that looked vaguely monstrous was always evil. And I think it's really, really important that the Pertwee years really challenge that, and this story really, really challenges the view that alien equals evil.
Yes, there's a lot of instances in the Pertwee era of misguided ministers, misguided businessmen.
Yeah.
I agree, and I entirely like the idea that the aliens aren't evil and that there's humans responsible for it. It's just the fact that rather than Carrington being a baddie in the traditional sense, and it makes sense, and he's seen them and he's got their proper backstory and he's militaristic. It's just a bit disappointing after 7 episodes of this and him walking around being perfectly convincing to everybody, which is, you know, how he's managed to pull this off, to then turn out that he's just a bit out of sorts.
I'm not sure he's a bit out of sorts. I think he is a racist nationalist, basically. I think he's got this very old-fashioned and traditional view about moral rights and the fact that we need to keep out the alien. And he would probably be applauding Enoch Powell's Rivers of Blood speech, which I'm sure, you know, that was made in, 68? I'm sure that was somewhere in David Whittaker's mind when he was writing this story.
I guess, I don't know.
It's explicitly anti-immigration and anti-racist.
I almost want it to be that Carrington hasn't had his mind broken, that is how he is. And actually,
oh, I see what you mean.
He's someone who is like that, and that's why he has to be stopped. Not that seeing an alien has driven him like that. But, you know, it's Doctor Who, so I suppose it has to have an element of that in it.
Just on that ending, without wanting to dwell on it too much, it is one of my favourite bits of the story, because it isn't a big shootout climax where you don't go and see the aliens reunited. It's actually comes down to, yes, it's been a 7-episode epic, but it comes down to a very small story about one man's small-minded paranoia.
Yes, and the moment he's arrested, that's it.
And he's arrested and led away, and that's really the end of the story, because it's been a story about his wickedness, really, and his flaw. Mm. I know season 7 sometimes prays for its gritty realism and being adult, and we could argue that point, but I do think that's quite an adult ending, that actually it's the smallness of Carrington that makes him quite compelling. And I think when he says to the Doctor, I had to do my duty, I was thinking, part of me was thinking, ooh, that's like Yvonne Hartman. And then I switched the fan side of my brain off and thought, no. When the Doctor says, yes, I understand, the Doctor's kind of acknowledging, yeah, I understand that you were doing your duty. I don't agree with you, I think, but I understand why you did it.
Mm.
And he's kind of led away as a broken man. He's got nothing left. He's clearly screwed his career over. He's probably going to be locked up now in some asylum somewhere. So he's utterly defeated.
It's a very odd scene, because you're right. The story, you know, the story doesn't overstay its welcome. It says this is the point where he's been defeated. We stop here. And it's very economic in that sense. But it's a very un-Doctor Who ending. You do suddenly go, oh, you're literally stopping the story there, are you? You're leaving the alien standing in the
control.
And you go, well, actually, yeah, the story hasn't got anywhere else to go, but it's a very odd Doctor Who ending.
It is, and it's a very odd Pertwee ending, because normally he'd make some kind of moralistic speech that made the point that we must all be, you know, much more open-minded and all the rest of it. But I don't think he needs to. I think that's become clear, particularly in the final episode, through the Ambassador's basic reasonableness. The Doctor's communicating with them, and Carrington's obvious, slightly unhinged nature, I think it all becomes really apparent, and you don't need Pertwee to then spell out the message in a big moral speech.
Yeah. Just before we come on to maybe some of the problems the story has, because that we talked about some of the good things that it's trying to say, some of the things I liked about it, the cast are actually all pretty good and pretty memorable. Michael Wisher gets to turn up without Davros makeup as the TV presenter, and it's that kind of self-aware TV industry thing of, this kind of thing would be covered by TV, so we'll do the kind of behind-the-scenes TV announcer bit of storytelling, which is quite fun, particularly in the last episode where he starts talking as if he's doing a broadcast and then goes, so that's how I'll start my segment. That's quite fun. Also in the last episode, Jeffrey Beavers, Caroline John's husband, turns up as a unit soldier well before he then comes back later to play the Master.
Yeah.
John Abernary is very good as Carrington. I really like Rafe. I was going to say Rafe. I don't know why I always want to call Ralph Cornish Rafe. Ralph Cornish. I'm not sure he's even called Ralph on screen by anyone, is he? He's called Ralph in the credits. But I don't remember anyone actually. Maybe he's introduced as Ralph Cornish in the first episode.
I can't remember it. I think he's just called Professor Cornish.
They call him Mr. Cornish. But I like him a lot. Is it The Dying Days? Does he turn up in The Dying Days? Or does Lance Parkin make him gay in The Dying Days? I think someone in The New Adventures randomly decides that Ralph Cornish is gay, and maybe it's in The Dying Days. But he's a strong character who, and particularly it's a very strong performance. Is it Ronald Allen?
Yeah.
And right there from the first episode, he's very watchable. And given that he's basically single-handedly running a space centre, it's quite important that he is quite watchable. There are that very season 7 thing, or actually quite Doctor Who thing generally, of quite happily putting female scientists, which is nice to see. So looking after the countdowns, looking after discussions with the rocket. Obviously none of them are allowed to be in charge, but you kind of have it a bit with Petra in Inferno. You mentioned
the very first actors we see on screen in colour in Doctor Who are a unit,
radar,
a couple of unit boffins in a radar place, and it's the woman who's clearly in charge. The bloke's just numpty doing the pressing the buttons, and she's the one that's making the decisions. And I think that's a really nice way to set up the important, that it's slightly near future, and actually women are in much more senior roles than maybe people are used to seeing on TV. I think this story in particular really maxes out on that near future tack. with the whole Mars landing. So clearly, if you're watching in 1970, you would have just seen the moon landing almost certainly, and you'd be thinking, oh well, this is, you know, not implausible that in 5 years' time that we could be landing on Mars and doing expeditions to Mars.
Yeah.
It has some slightly futuristic technology, the vans, like the advanced spacesuits and things like that, so...
It has some kind of female scientists at the Space Centre. It doesn't do very well for female parts overall, but then it doesn't really have much opportunity to. I mean, it doesn't... It would be nice maybe if one of the astronauts was a woman.
Yeah.
It doesn't quite feel it's up to that. And but almost every other incidental character is a villain. And so they could have made the minister a woman, but then basically the first female minister in Doctor Who would have been evil.
Mm.
Or at least misguided. But Liz has plenty to do in this story, and because
she kind of get locked in a room with Cyril Shapps for quite a large part of the story.
Oh, there's a Shapps for that. She does, but
she does
while she's there. Proactive. She's getting to press buttons and cook up plans, and it's nice that she's working separately. And even then, even at the very end, once the Doctor's really basically gone, yeah, I've done all my stuff here, he's basically leaving Liz in charge to help them mop it all up as the kind of token unit scientist.
She's more practical than I am.
Yes, yeah. One other thing I liked was the... I say liked. The design of that room where the Doctor has his console. Is that the Doctor's house that we saw at the beginning? With the flowery wallpaper and... He and Liz are somewhere doing time travel experiments. It doesn't look like any version of Unit HQ we see.
We had a bit of a chat at the start, didn't we, where we said, because the Doctor has yet another jibe about the Silurians being blown up by the Brigadier at the start, and we had a bit of a chat to say, well, it would be quite nice to think, actually, after the Brigadier commits genocide against the Silurians, that maybe the Doctor's flounced off and is refusing to go to work, and this is the first time since the Silurian incident that he's actually got involved in anything UNIT's doing.
Yes, I think it's probably only a week or two. The way the Doctor talks about it implies that the Brigadier's gone off to do this. He says, like, you know, now he's finished blowing up the Silurians.
Yeah.
That actually there isn't a lot of time difference, but that the Doctor has avoided him since the Silurians and is only really going down because he's interested in what he's seeing on the TV. Mm. He isn't actually...
It does feel like he's just turned up because he's heard the strange alien voices, and actually, you know, we don't know what's gone on before. This is pure invention on our part. But it'd be nice to think that he's kind of walked out on the Brigadier after the end of the Silurians, and this is what tempts him back to UNIT.
Mm.
But there's nothing on screen to actually make that any more than a suggestion.
Yes. So, moving on to the flip side, there are two things I think are wrong with the story.
Mm-hmm.
One is that... Unlike
the acting and the script.
Unlike the stories either side, it doesn't justify its length.
No,
it has a lot of escaping, getting captured, repeating bits of, you know, adding extra levels of complication just to make it longer. And the story itself isn't deep enough to warrant the 7 episodes that it's stretched to.
Yeah.
So that's a fairly big thing. The other is, there are plot holes everywhere. There's so much stuff that just doesn't make sense. I mean, there's little things where you think they just haven't thought this line through, and bits of technobabble don't work. So early on, right, so Mars Probe 7 goes up into space, and then Recovery 7 goes up to retrieve things. So you kind of assume, well, for start, Recovery 7 must be a recovery module that's been sent up specifically to do this. So and it's presumably called Recovery 7 because it's going for Mars Probe 7.
Yeah.
Maybe they have one recovery module for every Mars trip, but it seemed unlikely. And then they say, when they're discussing how they, you know, after Recovery 7 is lost, they're saying, well, maybe we can send up Recovery 8. When's that scheduled for? Why would Recovery 8 be scheduled at all if it's a recovery module?
Well,
It seems odd that there's even another one.
Maybe, though, whenever they send anything up, they always start preparing another capsule for recovery.
Possibly.
So maybe they're
always
supposed to be... They
sent up 6 recovery modules before.
No. I think your conjecture is right that it's called Recovery 7 because it's Mars Probe 7, but they probably...
We're preparing
a Recovery 8
for Mars Probe 8.
Yeah. Well, or any time maybe they send something up, they start immediate work on preparing the next capsule available to go up just in case there's some kind of accident. Well, no, just as a, you know, contingency.
Well, it's the fact that they call it Recovery 8, and then later on, the doctor goes up, and they said the doctor's come back up and gone up in Recovery 7.
Yeah.
So he's presumably using the capsule that they cut the door off, which seems slightly odd, rather than the Recovery 8 capsule, where maybe it wasn't, it's not ready.
Or alternatively, if your numbering system works, then it would Recovery 8 would become Recovery 7 again, because it's going to get Mars Probe 7. It's only Recovery 8 because Recovery 7's already up there, and they number them sequentially.
The numbers are very odd. Normally in space missions, you have the same ships, but you number them.
I'm sure this is going to make a fascinating podcast.
Oh, no, anyway, well, to be honest, it is the least of my criticisms.
Should we talk about the Doctor's magic hand?
That's exactly what I was saying. That was next on my list. We have a lovely, lovely helicopter attack, which works really, really well and is really excitingly directed. And then we have the Doctor doing a nice bit of old man acting, tricking General Carrington and his goon into stopping their vehicle and getting out to help him with Bessie. And then he presses a button marked anti-theft device.
Anti-thief device.
And their hands stick to Bessie.
That's not even the most preposterous moment of magic in the story. I mean, let's face it, it's a David Whittaker script, and let's be thankful that the Doctor hasn't got some mercury available at all. Got a bit of mercury and static electricity, and God knows what would have happened.
Quick, Liz, rub this balloon against your hair.
Well, she is actually wearing quite a woolly-looking jumper, so maybe if she'd rubbed a balloon against her balloon...
And then smash this thermometer.
There, the plot all fixed.
Yeah, the point you referred to is, of course, the moment where he holds out a very, very large reel of tape and makes it vanish into thin air.
Just why the hell? Who thought that was a good idea? And then there's the magic baker's laundry van where they press a button and the whole side kind of magically changes by stop motion animation.
At least that's no, but basically they've got like a Kindle display. It's just e-paper. This is the near distant future.
Well, no, that's not even the most preposterous thing about the van, because then apparently either the bakers or the laundry can just drive into any top secret establishment.
Yes, that is the more preposterous.
This
thing,
reminds me of the start of Carry On Spying, where the milkman can just walk in. Milkman.
So, what else do we have? Oh yeah, once Regan has managed to gain entrance to one of the bases in episode 5, when the Doctor's about to go up in Recovery 7 or 9 or whatever, he breaks in, and his attempt to sabotage this is to run around just turning every handle he can find in the refinery. And have you got a plan here? Or is your plan genuinely, I need to screw up the fuel supply, so I'm going to assume that if I turn every handle, something will go wrong. It is rather odd. Then the Doctor takes off, and we have the most ridiculous version of physics for the Doctor's space launch. So apparently, if you go too fast out of the Earth's atmosphere, then you'll end up plunging into the sun. Now, obviously, if you go too fast, you will end up plunging into the sun, but he's kind of going a bit too fast.
Not necessarily. If you go too fast, you'll just shoot out of the solar system entirely.
Yeah, absolutely. But you might, if you're going towards the sun.
Yeah.
But yeah, this idea that if the Doctor goes a bit too fast out of the Earth's gravity, within 15 minutes, he will be in the sun.
It does kind of suggest that David Whittaker thinks that the sun and the moon are almost exactly the same distance away from the Earth.
Yeah, and no wonder these Mars trips are going so well. They're only 2 minutes away.
Yeah, exactly. Well, even going to the moon took days, didn't it?
And then
15 minutes to the sun is bloody such, because it takes 8 minutes for light, I guess.
Exactly. So the Doctor says, well, let's jettison the booster. And then go, but if we jettison the booster, you might not be going fast enough. I just went, well, wait a bit longer then before you jettison it.
But to be fair, we do get the lovely bit of Roger Moore face in Moonraker while the Doctor's going up.
With
wrinkles flapping against his ears.
Someone's blowing a fan onto his face, aren't they?
Yeah.
I wasn't all that impressed. Then in episode 6, I have to say, once the Doctor gets up into space, we do get the important plot twist of the story, which is 6 episodes in, the shock reveal that the aliens are ambassadors. hadn't occurred to me watching a story called The Ambassadors
of Death.
That they might possibly have been ambassadors. To be fair, actually, it hadn't occurred to me because it's the kind of lurid title. You know, they are bringing death. And so actually, it is quite a nice twist that they're called Emperor. But you do kind of go, the shock might be greater if the story wasn't called that.
Yeah, death from outer space might have been equally lurid but less revealing, wouldn't it?
Yeah. And then once he meets the aliens and they want their ambassadors back, I am a bit bemused by the aliens' motivation at all. Presumably, the reason they sent the ambassadors back was because General Kenton made contact and arranged it, and they thought they were doing something happy. And then they got trapped on Earth and they wanted them back again. But then their threat is, well, unless you give us our ambassadors back, we'll destroy your planet.
Yeah.
And then the Doctor says, well, can I take the astronauts back? No, we're keeping those. Well, they're not exactly needed as collateral, are they, if the threat is we'll destroy your planet?
Maybe they weren't sure that Parliament would agree for them launching a strike.
So. That's possible.
It's just posturing.
But also, they're powerful enough to destroy the planet. And you know, this is feasible. They're powerful enough to destroy the planet, but not to pop down to the surface, get their alien ambassadors and get back up again.
Yeah. Again, it's kind of a plot hole because it's unexplained. You know, you could think of explanations like, well, maybe...
They have an Alderaan destroying device, Death Star style, but they don't have a teleport.
Yeah. Or maybe, you know, if they try and go down there, no,
they're worried they'll get caught.
They're worried they'll get caught as well.
Absolutely.
It's just going to get worse and worse. So you don't know. I think more interesting is, why did Carrington invite a load of aliens back if he doesn't want aliens coming to Earth?
Yes. So, well, is he trying to...
I think he's trying to alert the world.
He wants to alert the world, and he wants to lure the spaceship in so that they can destroy it.
Which I think is a brilliant story to tell, given that they've decided on this Trapped on Earth format. But to do the story where someone wants to reveal the things that UNIT trying to keep secret, it's a plot that you could imagine something like Torchwood doing.
But General Carrington's managed to get himself made the head of space security.
But to be honest, he was an astronaut to start off with, so it probably wasn't that difficult.
No, I'm saying that's absolutely fine. He's the head of space security, which is like the British version of UNIT. And then he uses his position as the
head of space security.
He's the space head of space head security. And he gets the space aliens, and he steals them from UNIT so that he can reveal the threat they are to the world.
Space threat they are to the world.
But then he gets a whole other bunch of goons to space steal the space aliens away from his own space security service. Probably because he thinks that Brett Vion's actually gone to UNIT instead of working with
it. Possibly.
But given that the government...
High on mercury fumes.
Given that he's working with the minister, and the minister's happy with this whole thing, and the minister agrees with him, presumably, about the need to expose the AI or whatever, why does he steal them from himself and move them to a whole other facility? Why not just...
It's deeply bizarre.
I tell you why, to add another episode.
To add another episode, I suppose maybe he was wanting to use them to commit some murders and assassinations so that people realise how evil the aliens are and how dangerous they are and how they must be stopped.
Possibly, but he thinks they are. It seems odd that he thinks people need convincing rather than just showing why they wouldn't have the same reaction as him.
Well, maybe he just wants to be doubly sure that people think they're evil and that no one says, well, maybe, you know, has anyone asked them if they're nice?
And given that he wants to do that, it's odd that he is quite so keen to build a communication device with them.
Yeah.
His goon, yes, because his goon wants to rob banks with them.
Yeah.
But for him, it's a bit of an odd step.
I did quite like the scene, actually, where the Doctor says, for the last time, I'm not going to join you in a bank robbing operation or something like that.
Yes.
So the Doctor's reduced to the level now and is quite peeved that he's been reduced to the level where he's having to trade banter with a bank robber rather than the Emperor of the Daleks.
Yes, although it looks especially like Liz was all ready to go along with the bank robbing if the Doctor hadn't arrived.
Well, she's got a kind of gangster's mole hat, hasn't she? I think she could be a bit kinky for the rough guys.
Tramps! Then we have also in stupid plot things, the Doctor, after meeting the aliens and finding out what the plot is and that the aliens are all innocent ambassadors that must be returned to save Earth from destruction, decides, because he's on some kind of insecure frequency, not to tell the Brigadier or Ralph Cornish this, even though it's pretty vital information for the future of Earth's survival, and instead wait until he gets back. Given the difficulty of getting from space to Earth, that's quite an important bit of information to risk losing in a bad re-entry.
Yeah.
Oh, the Doctor burnt up and forgot to tell us who the alien ambassadors are, so we can't save the Earth. Great.
Well, Yeah.
But of course, for dramatic purposes, they need to find out much later. And then, of course, also for dramatic purposes, later on, the aliens are quite happily to radio in the last episode and appear on screen and demand their ambassadors back, which apparently they didn't want to do before.
Yeah, that's true. Very strange.
It would all have been much more convenient if they just rung up in episode one and gone, look, we've got some issues with our ambassadors.
Yeah, that is slightly problematic that they had their communications device all along up on the alien spaceship and were quite happily able to converse with the Doctor, so why didn't they just phone someone up?
Yeah. So, there are a few things that bugged me.
A few things. So, overall, I definitely don't think it justifies its length, and I think it becomes very convoluted because there isn't the plot to sustain seven episodes unless you make it ridiculously convoluted.
Yeah.
And so thence the plot holes arise.
And I quite like the idea of you reveal General Carrington as a villain, but then he's not a villain, he's just working for a different bit of the government, but then he is the villain after all.
I think David Whittaker's always been more interested in human villainy as well, because we were talking during the programme that the Rescue has a human villain and actually the aliens aren't evil. The Enemy of the World is practically the only Troughton story where there aren't any aliens and it's all human villainy, and it's almost as convoluted as the Ambassadors of Death. And even something like The Power of the Daleks, obviously the Daleks are evil, but they're almost
playing on
human villainy and taking advantage of the bad things going on the colony of Vulcan. Yeah. So,
and it reminded me
very Whittakerian.
And the story did remind me a bit of that kind of thriller element and the dodgy general and all that. Reminded me a bit of Invasion of the Dinosaurs. That was the one I kind of felt it was close to.
I felt it was similar, but I also felt it was close to the kind of Faceless Ones as well. Another Mac Hulk story where there's aliens, but they're working with people and there's lots of strange things going on.
The other thing we should mention about this story, which isn't inherent in the story itself, is the colour.
Yeah.
I found that it is a recolourised story for the most part, and I did find it much harder to watch after the first episode. It was slightly fascinating watching the strobing and the multicoloured water that Liz was risking falling into. Much as I entirely applaud the ingenuity and innovation and hard work involved in even restoring the story to that level from just black and white, it is still quite painful to watch some of those, someone with the blue jacket where it's strobing in multiple colours all the way through. It's still got a long way to go to be as good as new, hasn't it?
I'm sure they'll keep pushing the technology. I didn't find it painful to watch.
I felt it distracting.
You probably found it distracting because I was trying to point out which bits came from the NTSC tapes and which bits were the colour recovery things, and pointing out the strobing on the NTSC tapes versus the weird mosaic on the colour recovery.
Quite painful to watch.
I think that's possibly more a comment on my fascination with the magic of colour recovery than it is on the actual success of it. I do think the first episode obviously exists on its original UK broadcast tape. Then episode 2 and 3 are probably the ropiest colour, particularly episode 3, where there are some scenes that look like they're in black and white with a little bit of colour.
The girl in Schindler's List.
It is almost, because there's one scene where Liz and the Doctor look like they're the only colour things in a scene that's otherwise just grey. One where they kind of drive up to a facility and the grass in the foreground's vaguely green, but everything in the background's black and white.
You can really see the effect of the intensity of colour on the success of the chroma dot recovery process. Yeah. So where there are really strong colours, like the yellow of Bessie or the red of the military hats, it's absolutely fine, or the red of the Doctor's cape lining, it comes through really, really well. But where people are a bit in the distance and they're not as strongly, their faces very quickly wash out. Yeah. Any kind of buildings in the background turn into black and white and you get in the focus entirely in the foreground of the colour.
I don't think that's true all the way through. I do think episode three, the colour's tenuous at best. But I think once you get 4, 5, 6, 7, I think the colour's fine there. It's comparable to, like the Silurians or whatever. It's really only those two early episodes where there's obviously real problems with the colour. And I still, I wouldn't say it's painful to watch. I still prefer to watch it like that, in an approximation of colour than in pure black and white.
Yeah, I'd much rather that than black and white, although really ropey into your sea copies.
But overall, I think you're right. It's not entirely successful, but yes, plaudits for even getting it to that level.
Yeah. The other thing we should say, I suppose, is because this is Pertwee's first season, and I won't say it's only his third story, because his first two stories have involved 11 episodes, but I think it shows how quickly and easily he does settle into the role. He's completely defined it as his own very, very quickly. He's very much kind of established his character and his mix of gentle sarcasm and grumpiness that you know, is never, certainly not in this story, it's never too much. So, you know, he's a bit irate and impatient, sat waiting for liftoff because he's just not getting to do anything, and he's got that kind of nervous energy wanting to be fighting the good fight. Yeah. And yeah, he's actually just sat there waiting for bureaucrats to do their tests and fill the fuel in. And yeah, getting slightly annoyed with Cornish early on because he's not immediately deferring to him. But he's very watchable all the way through, and entirely, you know, in charge and the centre of attention whenever he's in a scene.
No, I entirely agree. I think Pertwee's absolutely stunning. And I love the scenes in particular where he meets the aliens who are kind of locked up and he's looking through the window trying to communicate with them. I think he says at the end, "Oh, take that gentleman out of the tube where he's imprisoned or whatever." And it's similar to when he kind of offers his hand to say, "Oh, you must be a Silurian. Hello, how are you?" And you know, he's utterly unfazed by aliens. He's fascinated by them, but he treats them just like people.
Yes, so you have it in his obsequiousness to the Draconian Emperor in Frontier in Space, don't you, as well? He's entirely relaxed.
Yeah.
A citizen of the universe.
Absolutely. The only other thing that I wanted to mention was, I was sitting all the way through thinking, those alien ambassadors, their voices sound really familiar. I was racking my brains.
Oh, it's the guy down the chip shop.
It is.
Mr. Elvis. Papadopoulos.
No, they are the voices that are used for Arcturus, I think, in The Curse of Peladon.
Right.
It's that same voice.
Although it's a different
fascinating
actor.
Fact.
It isn't. It's Terry Bale in The Curse of Peladon, but it's Peter Halliday, in this, of Dalek voice fame. Cool. That was season 7 and The Ambassadors of Death. Let's fire up the randomizer.
Let's do it.
Oh, that was unexpected. I'm not even sure this has happened to us before.
Is it season 8?
It's not, but it is another Pertwee season. I don't think we've had the same Doctor back-to-back before.
I don't think we have.
Yeah, we've done 7, 9 and 10, so if it's not 8, it must be...
11.
It is. So, we're sticking with Pertwee, but a different companion, and we have the choice of the Time Warrior, the story we were just talking about, Invasion of the Dinosaurs, Death to the Daleks, the Monster of Peladon, and Planet of the Spiders.
Mm-hmm.
And that is quite an interesting selection as well, as is the case with seasons 9 and 10, 2 4-parters, and 3 6-parters.
Yeah.
You kick off.
So, The Time Warrior is one of my all-time favourite Doctor Who stories ever. I think it's one of Pertwee's real strongest performances. There's so much that I love about his performance in The Time Warrior. It's obviously the first Santarin story. Even more importantly,
let's not discuss the Santarins again.
The first Liz Sladen story. I love it. It's the only Third Doctor story where he actually kind of goes back and has a historical adventure that's not linked to some bizarre mythical crystal or, you know, it's actually not really in the past. He genuinely goes back to medieval times and has an adventure there. It's a Robert Holmes script. I adore it. Then we've got Invasion of the Dinosaurs. Again, very good. I think it works really, really well. Lots of great things about that, other than the dinosaurs. Death to the Daleks, less familiar with. Monster Peladon, I think I've seen it once. And Planet of the Spiders is obviously one of the all-time classics.
Planet of the Spiders is one of my all-time favourite John Pertwee's, all-time favourite Doctor Who stories, and John Pertwee gives a great performance. there's five to choose from. I've seen The Monster of Peladon, I think, once before as well.
Mm-hmm.
I have absolutely no intention of choosing it to watch for this. I know we could take the opportunity to reevaluate it, but let's not. So that leaves four.
Mm.
All of which have stuff going for them. Death of the Daleks is one of these stories I saw really early on in watching Doctor Who, because I kind of started watching Doctor Who in the very early 90s.
Mm.
And that was one of the stories that the friends who had the videos and showed me them had. And so it's an odd one to have watched. I kind of watched that, and Spearhead and Pyramids of Mars were kind of the three early ones.
I had The Time Warrior. The Time Warrior was one of the first two Doctor Who stories I had on video. I had that, and I had the Ark in Space, and they were both all edited into movie format at that point when the videos were released. So
you didn't even know that Link's taking his helmet off was a cliffhanger.
No, exactly.
I would be quite interested to revisit Death of the Daleks because I haven't seen it for so long.
Mm.
I do like Invasion of the Dinosaurs, and it would be interesting to now do the comparison with The Ambassadors of Death. No, I don't know. It's got lots of stuff going for it.
Yeah, I like it. But
The Time Warrior I know very well, and I'm not all that keen to watch. I mean, I don't love Death of the Daleks, but I kind of think it'd be interesting to see again. And Planet of the Spiders I'd quite like, and I think it'd be interesting to do the Deep Purpose finale story, but I haven't really got a lot of thought to choose between them.
It's strange you said that you're interested in revisiting Death of the Daleks, because when I was going through them, I was thinking, although Season 11 doesn't have a great reputation, the first two and the last story are really, really good, and I think people are right, The Monster of Peladon's probably dreadful, but Death of the Daleks has got a bad rap as well, and I'm kind of interested to see, is it bad, or is it just bit, that it's a bit Terry Nation-ish?
I think it's a bit naff. And I'm interested to see the stuff with the Exelon City again, although I just didn't remember it being all that good. You know, the Daleks were reduced to having guns. It's got a bit of that traditional 60s Dalek thing of the Daleks pretending to be nice and pretending to work together, isn't it? With humans, when actually they're not.
Hmm.
But then you go, is there a reason why we haven't watched it as much as the other three?
Yeah, I bought Death to the Daleks on VHS quite early on. It was an early story that I bought, and I got into the car. I bought it from W.H. Smith. I can remember getting into the car and opening it up, and for some bizarre reason, I don't know why, maybe it was just a habit I had, but I pressed the little button at the top of the tape and lifted the, you know, VHS tapes, yeah, used to be able to press the button at the side and lift
it. Check that the tape looked not neat.
Yeah, and it was...
It was a corpse!
Snapped.
Oh.
So there was just a broken tape. So I took it back. They didn't have another copy, so I ended up exchanging it for The Mind Robber, which became the first Patrick Troughton story I had on VHS. Anyway, I'm sure this is fascinating. So the upshot of that is I didn't then see Death to the Daleks till many, many years later, at a point when I was probably getting a bit of glut of VHSs, because I was earning my own money then, or at least I was getting a student loan, and I bought quite a few videos. So I've probably seen it as little, I would say, as The Monster of Peladon. So I am quite interested in watching Death to the Daleks.
Well, I do really like The Time Warrior, and I do really like Planet of the Spiders, but of course I can watch them whenever I want. I'm not barred from watching them because of this. So, yeah, let's give poor forgotten Death to the Daleks a go and see how it stacks up.
Let's do it.
Cool. Death to Daleks it is. Tune in for episode 20 and find out how that goes. Bye.
Bye.